Welcome to Modern Sign Books on Blog Talk Radio. If you're interested in what makes your favorite authors and collectors tick, then you'll love hearing what they have to say in our live interviews. Learn how they got started writing, the books and authors that inspired them, what they have in their personal collections, and much more. Meet today's hottest authors as they discuss their life and writing in revealing conversations with our book specialist, Roger Nichols. And find us at modernsignbooks.blogspot.com. Now sit back and enjoy a few minutes with Modern Sign Books. Here's Roger.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Roger Nichols. Our guest today is British novelist Andrew Grant. He began his career with three well-received novels about Royal Naval Intelligence Officer David Trevelyan, published a standalone about corporate conspiracy, and with his current book, False Positive, introduced what looks to be a new series character, Birmingham, Alabama detective Cooper Devereaux. Cooper, and I love this bit, who never allows himself to be called Coop or Coops, is a flawed cop searching for an abducted child. It is a fast-paced page-turner. We're delighted to welcome Andrew Grant.
Good morning, Roger. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
It is indeed a pleasure to talk to you. But before we get to the book itself, I'd like to explore your background a little bit, because you came to writing from an unusual angle. The always reliable Wikipedia says that you studied drama and English literature at Sheffield University and then founded a theatrical company that produced, and I quote here, original material critically successful, including an appearance at the Edinburgh Festival Fringe, but not financially profitable. So can you tell us about some of those productions, please?
That's absolutely right. I mean, it was a funny path to getting published, but I think it kind of makes more sense than it might sound on paper, because I actually never really set out to say, you know what, one day I want to be a novelist. But and that probably shows from, you know, different things I did, like working in telecommunications. But what I was always fascinated by, what I'd loved to do right from being a little kid, was telling stories. You know, wherever I went, I would just, you know, see things that I would then spin into ridiculous stories that I would tell my friends and my parents. You know, they always said to me that I would always set off with a kind of kernel of truth with what I was saying, you know, something that they knew really had happened. But they said when I was little, there was always this moment when I would say, and suddenly, and that would be when they knew I was launching off into some, you know, crazy fantasy. And that stayed with me, you know, all through school, right through university, because when I was at university, you know, I went to study English literature because I loved reading, but I didn't enjoy the process very much at university because it became so theoretical. You know, everything was about relating the fabulous books you got to read to whatever the current literary theories were, which wasn't fun for me. I wanted to come up with my own ideas and my own responses to them. So I had the opportunity to veer off into drama, which I much preferred because, you know, back in those days, if you were making a sound tape, it really was a tape. You know, it was quarter-inch tape that you had to go out and record stuff, and then you would literally cut the tape with razor blades, you know, and tape it together, and inevitably it would break at some critical point during the show, and you'd have to, you know, it was really fun. And the thing about theater, of course, is it's real storytelling. You know, it's people standing in front of you actually telling you a story, and I loved it. So after university, six of us decided, you know, the problem with studying something when you have exams to do is you kind of do enough to pass the exams, and then you have to move on to the next subject and do the next exams, you know. We felt that along the way we'd opened all these doors and kind of peeped through, but we hadn't had the time or the opportunity to go all the way through and really explore things to the full. So we thought, you know, before we get bogged down with the 9-to-5 and the mortgage and everything else, let's just take some time to really get to grips with all this interesting stuff. So we set up our own company and we ran that for, it went for about 2 years in the end. We wanted to do a certain number of things. You mentioned Edinburgh, that was one. We wanted to go on a national tour. We wanted to do various different shows. We did all of that stuff. It took slightly longer than we'd originally planned, but we did it all. But unfortunately, at the end of it, you know, we were completely broke because we'd only concentrated on doing the things that we wanted to do, you know, the shows that we wrote, the things that interested us. We didn't do anything that would really make any money. So at the end of it all, You know, we looked at it, we said, okay, we've achieved what we wanted to achieve. What are we going to do next? And a couple of the guys wanted to keep going. One of the girls wanted to go and be a lawyer. You know, different people wanted to do different things. I was fed up of being broke, so I decided to get a job just for, you know, a year or two, just to, you know, fix the hole in my bank balance. So I went down this extremely scientific route, because back in those days, of course, there was no internet, you know, there was no online job searching or anything. And in England in those days, if you wanted to look for a new job, you would get the Sunday paper and look in the situations vacant page. So I did that, and I ranked them all by, you know, the very scientific process of ranking them by starting salary, and applied for the one that offered the most cash, which was telecommunications. So I thought it would be a temporary thing, but I ended up being in telecoms for 15 years.
Why?
Until I was finally able to escape again. And what I found during that 15 years was that, you know, theater was, you know, was the thing I was obsessed with when I began, but I couldn't get to very many shows because the jobs I had always had me on the road. So I just naturally sort of migrated from theater as my, you know, means of storytelling through to reading novels, and gradually gravitated towards kind of crime novels and Cold War spy novels, those kind of things. And then, of course, the inevitable day came when I just thought, well, you know what, wouldn't it be fun to write one of these? Because then you get to decide who the good guy is and who the bad guy is and who comes out on top and what happens along the way. And once the fat sort of, you know, once that itch takes hold of you, eventually you've just got to scratch it. And so that was the sort of long answer to the question of how I ended up going from you know, theater and telecoms to novel writing.
And very nicely put, I might say. I wanted to ask a little bit about the actual troupe, though. What different roles did you play in that? Were you an actor? Were you a writer? Were you a stage manager? Or did you do all of it and kind of switch around?
Well, we did a fair amount of switching around, because with only six of us, you know, basically everybody had to get involved and do everything. But as we went along, we did kind of, there were certain roles that certain people kind of made their own. So, for example, one of the people was extremely good at costume and set design. So she tended to do that. There were kind of four or five of the others that were really good at the kind of collaborative development of the script. So they tended to do that. It sort of fell to me to do more of the kind of the technical and the business side. So just the logistics, you know, when you set out to conceive a show, if it's going to be a traveling show rather than one that's set in one place, then that sets you a very different set of challenges. You know, anything that you take on the road has to be transportable. It has to fit in whatever kind of van you've got. It has to be light enough to carry, you know. It has to fit on whatever stages that you have access to in the different venues that you use. You know, it has to lend itself to lighting with a much more simple rig if you're having to transport that too, you know. And the lighting board that will control the rig will probably be smaller too, so you've got less flexibility. So when you are setting out for something like this, you've got to do a lot of planning ahead of time. So I guess the Edinburgh Festival would be the ultimate example of that. We actually took two shows, and our decision was to spend all our money on getting a good venue, because, you know, there are thousands of shows at the Edinburgh Festival, and we figure however attractive you make your show sound, if somebody has to spend, you know, 2 hours walking in the rain to get to it, they're far more likely to go to one that's more central. So we went for a good venue. But then, you know, we had to say, well, once we've got that venue, what's going to fit in the room? You know, you've got a certain amount of time for your show, 2 hours we had, because we had the two shows, one after the other. So you've got all the time you spend setting up, you know, carrying your stuff in, setting it up and everything like that. That takes out of the time you've got to perform. So everything like that has to be really carefully planned and really, you know, slickly executed. So I ended up sort of taking on a lot of that role, which, you know, was, as I say, it's more kind of operational, if you like. I didn't do any really of the writing or the particularly creative stuff. The other guys were better at that than me, so they tended to do that side of things.
It occurs to me that perhaps all that organizational ability and background would be a wonderful grounding for organizing your writing.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't thought of it that way, actually. But particularly with a thriller, where you've got so many different threads of a story, and you have to arrange those threads in an extremely precise way. Hopefully, you can do it subtly so that it's not, you know, the nuts and bolts of how the thing is held together don't show too much. But, you know, it is extremely challenging to make all of the different strands work in the way that they're supposed to, you know, diverge at the right points, come together at the right points. You know, I think the best way to approach writing something is to think about what you like when you're reading. And as a reader, I love it when there are surprises, and I love it when there are things that I hadn't seen coming. But you have to feel that the signs were there, and you just hadn't picked up on them. You know, you got to look back and think, oh yeah, of course, I could see now that I know, of course, I could see how that would be. What you don't want is the, you know, the thing that's thrown in on the final page that nobody had any way of foreseeing, and it's just a way of kind of cheating, you know. So the way that you construct everything is really important. So yeah, I mean, that's a really good observation, that, you know, experience of putting together these strands in the physical world is actually very similar to doing it in the kind of imaginary world, which is what I do now.
So do you storyboard then, or is it all done on a giant computer screen? Does it work for you?
Yeah, well, it varies. It definitely varies person to person. You know, whenever you talk to other writers, you know, everybody's got a different system, and which is funny to me, because when I started, I assumed that, given that the process was kind of the same, you know, you start off with a blank page and you end up, you know, X months later with 500 pages or whatever, you know, you'd think, and obviously computers are involved and whatever, you'd think probably it's the same for everybody, but actually it's completely different. Everybody has a different way of finding their way through. And for me, it's varied a little from book to book. Each book seems to have its own sort of different demands. And what I like to do is, I'm not one of the kind of guys that has to have everything absolutely spelled out and laid down before I start. But at the same time, I do like to have I do like to have some idea of where I'm going.
Yeah.
So I do a lot of the early stages for me. A lot of them are thinking and planning and figuring out, you know, I generally start with the villain and think, who's the villain? What is he or she doing? What are they trying to achieve? What do they need? What's stopping them getting it? You know, work out the kind of things that they would realistically do given their situation, and then see how that would factor into the story and the different places that it would interact with the hero and what the hero's doing. So I try to be pretty clear about it, but I don't want it, you know, nailed down to the nth degree, because then I feel like it takes some of the kind of spontaneity out. You know, you want enough room. I like to know where I'm. It's as if I'm traveling across the city. You know, I might say, okay, I'm leaving my house and I want to end up at Navy Pier in Chicago. I know where I'm leaving from, I know where I'm going to, but I might want the flexibility on the spur of the moment to decide, oh, I'm going to walk by the lakefront, or I'm going to, you know, walk down Clark Street, whatever it might be. I like there to be enough room to be spontaneous as I'm doing it, but still with a good picture of where it is I'm trying to get to.
All right, we'd like to delve into your personal life, because that's what we like to do here. And that is, I love to hear how you and your wife, Tasha Alexander, met. And I understand when you got married in 2010, you were already both published authors. Wow.
We were, yeah. We were actually, she was already published when we met. My first book hadn't quite come out yet. So I was living in England at the time, and I had come over to the United States for... it was my first big kind of book convention. So I came over because my agent had said to me that it was time to start meeting people, you know, the reviewers and booksellers and so on, and start, you know, trying to, you know, get my name known. So I came over to start meeting people. And that was a little bit more daunting, excuse me, than it sounds, because, you know, coming from England, we, you know, it was a little a bit of a stereotype, but, you know, we do find it a little more difficult to kind of walk up to somebody in a crowded room and just launch into a, you know, a conversation about it. You know, let me tell you about me. You know, it's hard for us to do that. So I was there at this convention. The thing officially started on a Thursday, but really, all the action begins on the Wednesday in the bar. So I show up to the bar. It's this gigantic place that looks like a kind of football field full of people to me. And, you know, I'm concerned about, you know, what am I going to do? Go in and how am I going to strike up these conversations? But I take one step into the bar and I see Tasha standing there. And, all of a sudden I think, okay, different plan. and you know, things led on from there. So, you know, hence I'm now, you know, I've moved to the United States, living in Chicago and married to Tasha. So, you know, it was a very worthwhile trip to that bar for me, definitely. Didn't necessarily do what it was supposed to do for my career, but, you know, it certainly helped me in other ways.
And there's a difference between married and very married, and it sounds like you fall in the latter category too.
Absolutely, yeah, I would say so. So, and then it's, you know, it's a strange thing, because being married and us both being authors, it's being an author is a bit of a weird thing to do for a living, really. When you think about it, you know, sitting around making up stories is you know, not the most sensible way to put food on the table. So the two of us doing it, and the strange routines and the strange timetables that you get involved with, and the strange ways of working. You know, it's interesting, but I think it's actually really helped both of us, because sometimes it's quite hard when you're stuck in the middle of some problem in a novel. You know, you can't get the different strands to tie up the way you want. It's kind of hard to explain that, you know, especially if you had a partner who was, you know, a doctor or something. You know, they come home and their patients just died, you know, and you're whining because, you know, you can't make your story make sense the way you want it to. You know, at least we understand what those frustrations are like, you know, and I think that makes it easier to help and support each other. So, you know, it's a strange thing, but it works very well for us.
I think that in talking to other husband and wife author couples, all of them say it's a positive. You got a first reader right there in the house. You don't have to wait for anybody or email something off and wait for 5 days for them to get back to you. And you can reinforce each other because you know what you need to hear as an author. And sometimes it's, this isn't very good, or if you move this over here, that would all straighten out. So.
But yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And one of the funny things about being an author is that there's really no kind of, there's no external way of measuring whether you're on track. You know, when several of the jobs I had in telecoms were sales jobs. And in those jobs, you know, it's easy to tell if you're on track or not because you have a target, you know, and if it's, you know, if it's an annual target and you get to the end of the first quarter and you're not at least 25% of the way to hitting your target, you know that you're, you know, you need to do something different. If you, you know, if you're ahead of 25%, you know everything is good. Whereas when you're writing a novel, you've got quite, you know, from the outset, you've got quite a long time before your deadline, but you've got to use that time properly. You've got to do your research, you've got to write your draft, you've got to do all your revisions, you've got to get it to the best possible state you can before you send it off to your editor. And as you're going along, there's really, because there's no right or wrong answer that says it's got to be 25% of your time that goes on the research, or, you know, that's up to you. It's how you work, and it varies depending on the particular book you're writing. So there's nothing to tell you if you're on track. And what's even harder, when you actually start the writing part, you know, there's nothing that can tell you, is this any good or not, you know? And as you're going through, as it's just this one thing that you're wrestling with on your own, it's very easy to start getting trapped and start to think, oh, no, this is terrible. It's not going to make sense. No one, you know. So having somebody else who can objectively read it and as you said, the way that they can do that immediately is really useful, because otherwise, you know, you email it to somebody and you're waiting for a reply. You know, you fill that vacuum with all kinds of, you know, of terrible theories. So it's good to have somebody that can look at it straight away and somebody that you can trust, because it's no good having somebody that will just say, oh, it's brilliant, you know, even if it isn't. If it isn't, you need to know so that you can do something about it. So somebody that will look at it objectively and you know, give it to you straight when they've read it is incredibly useful.
You have, I believe, different writing styles and work in different genres. Is that helpful?
I think so. I think, you know, because, if, you know, I think we would be fine anyway, but, you know, there's no sort of direct competition between our books, and that it's you know, different. It tends to be, you know, some people will read both of our books if they read very broadly, but on the whole, people who read my books don't often read Tasha's, and to people who love Tasha's don't always like mine. So that's good, and it's also you know, it's interesting the way that we write so differently. Like we were saying earlier, you know, we both do the same thing in a way. You know, we produce a book every year, but at the same time, you know, she is the sort of person who, as soon as she wakes up in the morning, boom, she's 100% awake. She's ready to go. She can just start work instantly. Whereas me, you know, I'm like, I always liken it to kind of computers. You know, she's like the latest MacBook Air. You know, you open the lid and boom, ready to go. Whereas I'm more like one of those sort of old-fashioned hearing aid beige PCs, you know, that you've got to switch on and leave it for a couple of hours while it warms up, and, you know, I need a few cups of coffee, and, you know, it takes me a long time to get going. And my natural time for working really is late at night too. You know, her time is early in the morning, and I tend to go kind of nocturnal, especially as, you know, you're homing in on the end of the book and you get this kind of tunnel vision that sets in, and the only thing you can think about is working on that book and finishing that book. So, you know, you just revert more and more to your kind of natural way of working. So there's one time when we were both on deadline at the same time, and there were a few days where we would literally pass in the corridor. You know, I would be heading to bed right when she was getting up. It was kind of crazy that time, but you know, other than that, we generally work. Our apartment's got sort of strange layout, so, you know, I can work at one end of it and she can work at the other without us kind of disturbing each other if she's trying to sleep and I'm trying to work, or the other way around. So, you know, we fit in around each other pretty well, but the styles are very different.
That's fascinating stuff. Now, let's get into talking a bit about the work itself, because it's pretty fascinating too. And you got, you started out with the David Trevelyan series, and then you did the Mark Bowman standalone run. And now I believe this has got to be the start of a series, because Cooper Devereaux is really too intriguing a character to just be a one-off.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And yeah, you're absolutely right. I do. It is the start of a series. And of course, when you're starting off, you never know for sure how long the series will run. So I'm keeping everything crossed and hoping that it's going to be a very long running series. But, you know, I think there's plenty of scope with Cooper Devereaux to develop him, and to, I hope that he's a interesting enough character that people will want to come back and visit with him, you know, once a year if the series continues. And I had I had an awful lot of fun writing this book, because it was fun to do the Mark Bowman the standalone book run, because I wanted something which was a kind of line in the sand between my first series and this Cooper Devereaux series. And it was actually a lot more fun writing the standalone than I'd expected it to be. You know, so much fun, in fact, that I actually toyed with the idea of writing more standalones rather than launching straight back into another series. But ultimately, like I was saying earlier, you know, my guiding principle is always, you know, what do I like as a reader? And as a reader, I love a series. I love nothing better than getting really involved with a character and seeing what happens to that character, you know, time after time. So I thought the thing to do is to start the new series. And, you know, using, you know, Cooper and his adventures, I've had a wonderful time. The second installment is, you know, it's getting closer to being completed. It won't be on the shelves for a little while, but you know, there's at least one more to come, and I'm hoping there'll be plenty more after that too.
Now, you've switched venues pretty severely. I mean, from set in England to set in Birmingham, Alabama, and I think suspect that you picked Birmingham just because you were born in Birmingham, England. Is that correct?
Well, that was actually there were two reasons for picking Birmingham, Alabama, and you've nailed one of them. Yeah, as you say, I'm from Birmingham, England, and I really like the symmetry. You know, Chicago, where I live, is actually the sister city of Birmingham, England. So I like the symmetry that way. But I love, you know, Birmingham, Alabama was actually named for Birmingham, England, and I do like the symmetry of coming from one Birmingham and writing about another one. So that was one of the reasons. The other reason was that the way that the false positive, the first of the Cooper Devereux books, works, when I was imagining it or when I was sort of piecing it together in my head, what I realized was that for it to work, I needed a venue where it was feasible that you'd have a kind of cabin in the woods that was near to a major city. And I'm sure there must be hundreds or thousands of places across the United States where that could be true. But the only one that I really knew of, that I knew from the experience and that I'd been to and seen with my own eyes, was Birmingham, Alabama. So I thought, given that I know Birmingham fits the bill, and I like the symmetry because of having been born in Birmingham, England, you know, why waste time, you know, going on some kind of giant national tour looking for another place just to replace one that I already know will work. So those were the two main reasons for settling on Birmingham. And, you know, Birmingham is a very interesting place. I really like it's got lots of interesting buildings down there. It's a very distinctive place to be. And I think being born in one industrial city, and then I also spent a lot of time living in another one, Sheffield, England, which was a big steel-making center. There's something to me, I mean, it maybe is weird, but there's something to me about places where, you know, the big, important things which shape our modern world were made. You know, I feel drawn to those kind of places. So that was another reason for Birmingham standing out.
Fascinating stuff. It's impressive to see a British author capture the American culture so well. Is that because you divide your time between Chicago and Sheffield, that you had more comfort in that, moving that direction?
Well, first, thank you for saying that, Roger. And secondly, yeah, I think so, because, well, that's the way it would seem to me, because when I wrote those first three books, even though the two of them were set in the United States, I didn't feel confident to make the character American, you know, I didn't feel I could quite capture that. But I think since I've been living here, well, you know, being married to an American and living most of the time in America, and also, you know, there's a way in which if you see something through an outsider's eyes, you perhaps pick up on some of the details in a different way too. You know, I think if you combine those things, it got me to a point where I thought, you know, I think I am ready to give this a try. And, you know, thank you very much for saying that it was close to hitting the spot, because that was absolutely what I was aiming for. Yeah.
Excellent. In developing a new character like Cooper, do you have the whole thing in mind from the get-go, or are you, as you write more and more, does he develop as a character?
Well, I think it's a combination of the two. What I like to do is have the character's sort of key characteristics clear, you know, the things that he likes, the things that he hates, the things that are important to him, things that he's trying to achieve, you know, the things that are perhaps stopping him. And a lot of those can be internal things too, not necessarily to do with his, you know, his environment or his job or anything. And then that gives you the bones of the character. And then I think in each, what I would try to do is in each book show that character from a different angle, and then you can, you know, just try to see a different side of them and see how they respond in different situations and with different stimuli. And, you know, with Cooper, you know, he's a particularly interesting character, because it's revealed very early in the book that Cooper was, when he was a kid, both his parents were killed. So Cooper grew up as an orphan and had a pretty tough time, and his life was pretty much off the rails for long periods. And it was only when he was late teens, early 20s, that he really pulled himself back on track. And I think there's a lot of interesting material there. And, you know, what it does is it enables you to to just sort of, you know, you think about it and think, what kind of impact might this have had on a person? And there are some episodes that are described in that first book that, for example, lead to, I don't know if you notice this part, but Cooper won't have any closets in his apartment. He hates closets. He hates anything that's enclosed in that way. You know, all his clothes are hung on racks that are freestanding in his room. You know, he won't have anything with doors on, you know. So, you know, it enables you to, when you think about what's really important, what are the most fundamentally important things to your characters, you can then work out how they would show those or how those would be reflected in their everyday lives.
There are many intriguing twists and false positives, but one at the outset was particularly captivating for me. In American popular culture, the flawed cop with a bad disciplinary record to match the good arrest record is often paired with the young by-the-book rookie who he's a foil to react to the flawed cop's corner cutting. But in this case, Cooper is paired with Jan Laughlin, a vice cop with her own set of problems, and that makes for a whole interestingly different dynamic.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, that's what I was hoping, because, you know, it's so difficult to find anything that hasn't been done, you know, 100 times. So, and obviously the dynamic of a novel that involves detectives is the likelihood that you're going to have a partner involved. So one of the big questions you've got is how to make that relationship work. And, you know, I thought that, you know, the first thing that I thought about was Cooper's character. But then after that, the next thing I put a lot of time and effort into was trying to figure out an interesting partner for him to work with. You know, somebody who, I mean, she may or may not appear in other books. She's obviously not going to be as fundamental as Cooper is, but I still wanted her to be a fully developed, fully fleshed out character that was interesting and hopefully intriguing in her own right. Because, as you were saying in the question, the danger is if you only put a character in as a way of bringing out aspects of the hero, then they don't turn into a very interesting character themselves. You know, they turn into a device rather than than anyone that you can imagine as a real living, breathing person. So, you know, that was something that I was keen to avoid. So, yeah, I had a lot of fun developing Laughlin, and I think she turned into quite a fun character to be involved with.
What a question that just popped up: what aspect of this book makes you the most proud?
Well, actually, that's a very difficult question. You know, I really had a good time writing this book, and I think it, you know, of the ones that I've done, I think it would be the one that I was the most proud of. And I guess I like the way that the character of Cooper came out. I like the other characters that work with him, like Laughlin. I think that what he uncovers as the ultimate, you know, as the real crime in this book, you know, I found quite satisfying to work on, because just as a slight aside, what I was doing when I was starting to think about this series was I wanted to think about the you know, the FBI profiling people who will try to figure out what kind of person could have committed a particular kind of crime. You know, there are some crimes that are pretty obvious. You know, if a bank has been broken into and a bunch of money's been stolen, it's fairly obvious what was going on. But there are other kinds of crimes where the police will find the aftermath. You know, they'll discover a crime scene and there's no apparent motive. Now, of course, there always is a motive for a crime. And if you can understand what that motive is, it can help you to figure out what kind of person you should be looking at as suspect. And that's what these profilers do. And, you know, they're well documented in fiction, you know, from Silence of the Lambs onward. And I started off thinking that might be a really fruitful area to work with. So I got a load of criminal psychology books and memoirs from the FBI profilers themselves, and started thinking about the hero potentially as an FBI profiler. But in the end, I decided to approach it from a different angle and use all of this psychology and profiling stuff to help me to create more realistic, you know, weird and intriguing villains, but ones that I hope are more realistic, you know, because that their motivation is actually grounded in real psychology that has been seen, or, you know, similar things that have been seen. So I think the other thing that I'd be proud of about this book was that I was able to take aspects of real, I mean, it's strange stuff, you know, some of this criminal psychology is extremely weird and disturbing, but to take things that really do exist out there and use them as a foundation for, you know, the villain and what motivates the villain to do the things that are done. So I guess it's probably a long rambling answer, but that would be the things that I was the most proud of for this one.
Okay, a couple of points I want to touch on, because there's so many. I speak as a reader who really enjoyed this. There's so many sweet little bits in there, and I want to mention a couple of them. At one point, you write about cigarette butts on the ground outside the morgue, and the observation is the irony of stepping over things that kill you on the way to the place you go when you're dead. I love that line.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, you know, I think that's when, you know, you're talking about developing the characters, because, you know, when I set out, you know, there's a reason that Cooper had to go to the morgue to, you know, to interview someone. And that's what I set out knowing, okay, I've got to write a scene where he goes to the morgue. But then what I try to do when I'm writing them is to, you know, somebody, I didn't come up with this, someone else did, and I can't remember who it was, unfortunately, but they were saying one style of writing is as if you are seeing a film in your head, and then you're the journalist who's writing about, you know, who's recording it. And that's kind of how I write, you know. So I was looking through Cooper's eyes as he goes to the morgue to meet this person. And, you know, I was imagining what kind of things he would see. And it just struck me that, you know, there's a nice ironic twist there, you know. And I think that one of the most effective ways you can illustrate things, you know, sometimes, of course, you do need the big sweeping descriptions of things, but I really like to home in on those little tiny details, like, you know, the cigarette butts outside the door, or, you know, we were talking to Tasha the other day, we were talking about music, and there, you know, there's a band I like from England, and they would, in their songs, come up with things, you know, if they were describing the kind of urban decay, you know, or the sort of decline of the nation, you know, one of the things I homed in on was some graffiti underneath a highway bridge, you know, and there's one song where they just point out somebody, you know, there are all these sort of political slogans and other things, but then right in the middle, somebody's just written, "I'm sorry," and you just think, wow, you know, that little detail, what was that all about? What were they, you know? So I like those little details, like the cigarette butts, who, you know, they will just, you know, they just trigger something, hopefully.
Yeah, wow. It has been a real pleasure and a delight to speak with you today. I have to go and do some other things myself at this point, but I do want to thank you for being with us and for sharing. And our guest has been Andrew Grant. The latest book is False Positive, highly recommended. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Roger. Excellent questions and a pleasure as always. Thank you.
All right, thanks.
You've been listening to Modern Sign Books on Blog Talk Radio with book specialist Roger Nichols. Be sure to check us out at modernsignbooks.blogspot.com.